Chapter 51.
That big liquid natural gas carrier looks like a line of 8 pregnant women lying on their backs in a spa, said Jimmy Flett, as he stood at the console helm and closed on the Mongol invader. A helicopter, 2 cutters, and 2 F-16s blasted to scrap within 20 minutes, Giordino muttered, eyeing the wreckage floating everywhere, scattered among the waves by the smaller boats that sped through it. She's even deadlier than she is ugly. They'll never stop her now, Pitt said, gazing through a pair of 30x50 binoculars at the big ship doggedly heading for Manhattan and her rendezvous with nightmarish devastation.
She's about 1,000 yards from the bridge, judged Flett. Just time enough for us to cut in, submerge, and go for her screws and rudders. From Giordino's point of view, it would be a near thing.
We'll only get one pass. Miss, and we'll never be able to circle and come at her again. Her speed is too great. We couldn't surface, race ahead of her, and submerge for another try until she was long past the bridge.
Pitt looked at him and grinned.
Then we'll just have to get it right the first time, won't we?
The coral wanderer skipped over the waves like a smooth, flat stone thrown by a major league pitcher. Pitt swung his glasses onto the burning Coast Guard cutters. The William Shea was crawling toward the Brooklyn shore, the Timothy Firm listing and down by the stern. The smaller Coast Guard rescue craft had gathered around to put on extra men for damage control. The New York fireboats also pulled alongside, their pipes and nozzles, throwing a shower of water on the sections of the ships that were on fire. This was one time when the hounds were outclassed by a grizzly bear, he thought. He deeply regretted that they couldn't have arrived sooner and diverted the devastation. He had acted cocksure in his words of optimism to Giordino, but deep down he felt the chilling fear of failure. He was determined to hinder the Mongol invader and prevent her from entering the upper harbor, even if it meant putting his life and those of Giordino and Flett on the line. It was too late to turn back. The point of no return had been passed. All trepidation and uncertainty was left far astern. He knew with calculated certainty that Omo Kanai was on board. There was a score to settle, and he felt a growing wave of rage. He studied the shattered and shell-torn wheelhouse of the invader but saw no human figures moving inside. The hull below the funnel had more holes than a colander, but they were small and the damage looked slight. It seemed to take half a lifetime for the Coral Wanderer to narrow the gap. 200 yards off the starboard bow of the LNG tanker, Flett eased back the throttles and switched on the ballast tank pumps. Faster than Pitt might have thought, the luxury submarine slipped beneath the surface of the water as smoothly as if guided by a giant hand. Once submerged, Flett picked up the speed again, pushing the Coral Wanderer faster than her designers had specified. From now on, there could be no room for error. Giordino stayed on the bridge with Flett while Pitt dropped down to the main cabin and made his way forward to the bow and its big viewing port. Seated comfortably on a suede couch, he picked up a phone set in one armrest.
"Are we connected?" he asked.
"We have you on the speaker," answered Giordino.
Flett read off the numbers.
150 yards and closing.
"Visibility is less than 40 feet," Pitt reported. "Keep a sharp eye on the radar."
"We have a computer image of the ship as she sails," said Giordino. "I'll let you know what section of the hull we come in contact with."
3 agonizing minutes dragged by as Flett read off the closing distance.
100 yards out," he notified Pitt. "Her shadow is beginning to show above on the surface."
Pitt could hear the throb of the Mongol invader's engines and sense the rush of water under her keel. He peered into the green gloom and barely discerned the white foam that was sliding along her hull. And then her plates materialized out of the murk, 30 feet ahead and 10 feet above.
"We've got her," Pitt said sharply.
Flett instantly threw the twin screws into reverse, stopping the Wanderer before she rammed the invader.
"Take us down another 10 feet, Jimmy," 10 feet it is, acknowledged Flett, sending the Coral Wanderer on a course directly under the starboard side of the Mongol invader's hull. To Pitt, seated inside the bow observation cabin, it was an eerie sight to watch the great hull sweep over the submarine like a Chinook wind out of the north, a vast mechanical monster with no mind of its own. The beat of the propellers came as a distant pulse, but soon increased to the sound of a farm threshing machine. Something caught his eye, a large object that bulged from the bottom of the hull near the keel, but then it flashed from view. Pitt was an extension of Flett's eyes. Only he could make the split-second judgment call when the great bronze screws came into sight. The movement of the huge ship through the water was blurring his visibility. He moved forward and lay down on the carpet deck with his face less than an inch from the viewing port, eyes straining to penetrate the froth and green pall, to see the magnetic explosive charge on the end of the spar protruding from the bow of the Wanderer. But it was obscured by the restless water. Ready, Jimmy? Say the word, Flett replied, his voice solid as a stone. You should see the starboard prop only 3 seconds after it comes into my view on the bow. Nothing more was said as the suspense deepened. His mind and body as taut as banjo strings, Pitt's knuckles turned ivory as he clenched the phone only an inch from his lips. Then the green curtain parted in a white explosion of bubbles. Now, Pitt yelled. Flett reacted with the speed of a lightning bolt, shoving the throttles forward until he felt a jar from the front of the boat and then whipping them into reverse, praying that his timing was on a thin dime. Pitt could only watch, helpless and exposed, as the magnetic charge impacted against the steel plates of the hull and clung an instant before Flett went full speed into reverse. The massive propeller came like an out-of-control windmill, beating the water of the bay into sparkling foam. From the control bridge, Giorgino and Flett stared in rapt wariness, seeing the mighty blades pound toward them. For a brief instant, they were certain they could not pull clear in time, that the blades would beat the luxury boat into splinters and their bodies along with it. But in the final seconds, the Coral Wanderer's diesels roared and her own propellers chewed the water in a violent frenzy. She leaped astern as the LNG tanker's 50-foot diameter propellers flailed past no more than 2 feet from the bow viewport, rocking the submarine yacht like a tree whipped in a tornado. As he lay on the deck, arm raised and clutching the hand railing of a circular stairway for support, all Pitt could see out the viewport was a maelstrom of enraged water, embellished by the ear-pounding drumming of the spinning blades. A brief 30 seconds later, the yacht came back on a smoother keel. The water calmed into the Mongol invader's wake, and the throb of the propellers began to fade. "Now is as good a time as any, Al," said Pitt, coming to his feet. "You think we're far enough away?" "If this boat is built to withstand the water pressure at 1,000 feet, she can take the stress of a detonation 100 yards away." Giordino held a small black remote control in both hands and pressed a tiny lever. A loud thud sounded, amplified by the acoustics through the water. This was followed by a pressure wave that struck the Coral Wanderer with the force of a 20-foot swell before sweeping over and around. And then it was gone, and the water calmed again. Pitt popped his head above the deck at the head of the stairway. "Bring her up, Jimmy, and let's see if we did any good." He looked at Giordino. "Soon as we break the surface, let's mount another charge." Unable to comprehend the source behind the muted underwater explosion, Admiral Dover was overcome with fleeting relief at seeing the Mongol invader swinging away from the channel and making a wide, sweeping turn back the way she had come. He could not have known that Pitt and Giordino on board a submarine yacht were responsible.
Everyone who wasn't wounded on the William Shea had been too busy to notice the unusual craft before it slipped underwater and rammed a magnetic charge of explosives just ahead of the Mongol invader's starboard propeller. The explosion had blown an 8-foot hole in the hull below the base of the propeller shaft, shearing it apart, while the rudder mounting, already damaged by the heroic suicide run by the Coast Guardsman, became jammed in a 45-degree position to port. The propeller dipped downward on a slanted angle, barely held by the outer stub of its severed shaft, while the big turbine-driven engine inside the machinery compartment abruptly tripled its RPMs and raced out of control before the chief engineer could shut it down. With the port propeller still turning at full speed and the starboard critically damaged, the bow of the ship pulled slowly, deliberately, toward Staten Island, around on a reverse course that would eventually return her to sea or keep her running in circles. The worst of the disaster has been averted, thought Dover. But would the crazy man in command of the LNG tanker carry out his plans and blow her up, knowing that he could still cause great loss of life and billions in damage? Dover had prepared for certain catastrophe after losing the fight, but now that a sudden miracle had occurred, he prayed that a Holocaust might still be avoided. If Admiral Dover was surprised at seeing the great ship suddenly reverse its course, Omo Kanai was stunned into absolute confusion. Though he had felt and heard the explosion deep beneath the Mongol invader's stern, he had felt no concern, since no vessel or aircraft within 20 miles would dare to attack him. Then as the ship began its unscheduled turn, he shouted down to the engine room.
Get back on course! Can't you see we've come around?
We've lost our starboard screw from some kind of explosion, replied the chief engineer, anxiety obvious in his tone. Before I could shut down the port engine, its screw pulled the ship around.
Compensate with the rudders, Kanai ordered.
Impossible. Something struck the port rudder earlier, wreckage maybe, and jammed it, adding to the uncontrolled turn.
What are you telling me? Demanded Kanai,
beginning for the first time to lose his composure. The words came back steadily and lifelessly. Either we continue to go around in circles or we come to all stop and drift. The truth is, we ain't going nowhere. It was the end of the trail, yet Kanai refused to accept defeat. We're too close to give up. Once under the bridge, no one can stop us. And I'm telling you, with the starboard rudder jammed 45 degrees to port and my starboard screw useless with a broken shaft, the sooner we get off this gas can, the better. Kanai saw it was fruitless to argue further with his chief engineer. He stared up at the great bridge. He could almost look straight up at the suspended roadway as it began to fall away astern. Less than a few hundred feet had separated success and utter failure before the Mongol invader had been diverted by the mysterious explosion. He had come so close and defied the odds. It seemed impossible that triumph had been snatched from him at the beginning of the end. His eyes swept the water. It was at that moment that he saw what looked like a private yacht cruising in the wake of the invader. There is a strange look to it, he thought. Kanai was about to turn away, but then stared with sudden understanding and anger as the yacht suddenly slipped beneath the waves.
Okay, Jimmy, Pitt said to the submarine yacht's skipper. We turned her. Now let's put those big balls of gas on the bottom. I only hope those devils don't set off the charges, Flett said as he worked the controls to level the Coral Wanderer at 30 feet and make another run at the LNG tanker. If there was the slightest thought of hesitation, none showed in the old seaman's ruddy face. If anything, he looked as though he was enjoying himself for the first time in ages. The Wanderer was running under the water as if she were a fish.
Flett felt more at ease now that it looked as though they might not damage his precious boat. He set his eyes on the radar screen and the GPS to keep his course straight toward the invader.
"Where do you want to hit her?" he asked Pitt.
"Below the engine room, port side of the stern. Careful not to set off an explosion in the hull under one of those tanks. We put a charge too far forward and the whole ship could go up and everybody within 2 miles along with it."
"And our third and last charge?"
"Same area, but on the starboard side.
If we can put a pair of big holes in her stern, she should slip under the water quickly, since she doesn't have a deep draft."
Giordino spoke with a curious look of satisfaction on his face.
"With no screws to contend with, this run should be a piece of cake compared to the last one."
"Never count your chickens before the check clears the bank," Pitt retorted, as he had on other occasions. "We're not ready for bed yet."